Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. The way music has been stored and listened to has changed so much in the past few decades, but many people keep coming back to one of the original mediums, records. Greg Hall is the current owner of Used Kids Records, a staple of the music scene in Columbus. Today, we'll be talking about the store, its history, and why records still continue to be a popular way of listening to music. Welcome to All Sides, Greg.
Thanks, Amy, for having me.
So, musical mediums have changed so much in the past few decades. Vinyl, cassette, CD, MP3, streaming services. What sets vinyl apart, in your opinion?
Physical. It's a medium. You can touch it, feel it, smell it. It's right in front of you. You can actually read the liner notes. Mm. You can see the pictures. I mean, that's the physical part of it, but also just the interaction with a 12-inch piece of vinyl, putting it on your turntable. It kind of requires people to slow down a little bit. It's not like 30 seconds on TikTok or whatever. You know, it's there. You're going to listen to it. You're going to enjoy it. It's also something that I find that people share. There's a community around physical media. And we see that when we have listening parties at the record store. We see that by customers coming in repeatedly buying all kinds of different music. And it's primarily in that LP 12-inch format.
Tell me about the sound on a record versus, because you can physically hold a CD or a cassette tape, but I have been told numerous times that it's the sound of the...
I'm a little bit more cynical or skeptical of that, quite honestly.
Yeah.
My whole thing is I really don't care how people engage with music. Mm-hmm. Honestly, to me, it's about the music. It's not about the physical as much, but I believe the physical is actually the best way to enjoy music. As far as the audio part of it, you know, if you're in your car listening to a CD, in your car listening to a cassette, kind of hard to play an album in your car.
A little bit, yeah. So Spotify was recently in the limelight for featuring AI bands in their collection. Yeah. The AI band Velvet Sundown had over 1 million streams on the platform. How do you think the physical media, it's supposed to be a refuge from a screen, but how do we do this in an increasingly AI'd world?
Wow. Revolt.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think engaging with physical media is kind of a revolt. Mm-hmm. Not burying your head in your phone, not engaging with a human being across from you. I mean, it's a physical contact. It's, you know, you're right across from me, Amy, right now. I'm looking at you. I can't quite touch you. You're too far away from the table here or on the other side of the table. It just, you know, there's a book I read called The Revenge of Analog, and this is several years ago. And I bought a big stack of them for my staff. I said, you got to read this. And it's a pretty straightforward book about physical, you know, whether it's a notebook, you're writing, actually writing with a pen and paper. It's taking photographs, filming, real film. So it gets away from that AI fake construct of stuff. It's kind of fun, AI, but when it really kind of means that I'm not engaging in the physical world or the real world, I think it gets too dark.
So you wouldn't be 100% anti-AI, but
no.
maybe, you know.
It's kind of funny. I'll do some kind of knowledge-based thing. I have a basic question, and it's a Google search. But it comes up with an AI-generated answer. Mm-hmm. Quite often, I find that to be extremely helpful. Quick, fast. My pace is such that I don't have time to slow down.
Yeah.
Well, that is my research, the AI answer or the Google answer. But ultimately, you know, yes, I think there's definitely a place for it. I think both worlds can exist exceptionally well. But I also think the revenge of analog is that human beings ultimately are physical things. We need to interact. And whether it's at this coffee cup of water or me talking to you, Amy, it ultimately is critical for our existence. We can't sit with goggles on and headphones and hide ourselves from the world.
Well, speaking about being in the same room with people, Youse Kids hosts many events in the record store. You have record releases, signing parties, live shows. Why is it important to you to have these live events?
I mean, certainly there's a business side of it.
Yeah.
But for me, it ultimately does come down to some of the heritage that School Kids, I'm sorry, I said School Kids, but that's part of the equation here, that School Kids really did inherit as Youse Kids. There's a guy named Kurt Schieber. He used to own a record store called School Kids Records. That's how I paid my way through college, working for Kurt and Mark Mormon. And they did a ton of cool stuff on this campus, booking bands from SST, 4AD bands such as Cocktail Twins, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, you know, just really cool stuff. Well, it brought energy to the music scene, whether it was hardcore, punk, rock. X was one of the bands. Replacements were huge. Violent Femmes, Kurt did. I mean, these were things that made Columbus, in my opinion, kind of helped move beyond the cowtown reputation that it had. And that's just around the campus area. But I think it's critical. It gives people a chance to engage, to know, get exposure to new music. It just, that energy, I think, is really critical for why those things are so important.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we are talking about Youse Kids Records, an independent record store here in Columbus with the owner, Greg Hall. So you bought the store in 2014.
Right.
Business was down at that time.
Right.
Why buy a record store?
Well, it's in my DNA. That's part of it. I've always been in the entertainment business, the movie business for a long time in what I call my suit and tie years. I no longer wear a suit and tie. But, you know, whether it's entertainment in any kind of form, I did go to Ohio State, graduated from Ohio State, paid my way through college at Ohio State, working at a record store. My family was always in the music education kind of thing. So, you know, it was in my DNA. And a combination of loving music and also being in business, buying a record store and having the opportunity to buy a record store made a lot of sense.
What did you do over the years to revamp the business, bring in new customers, kind of help it succeed?
There are a lot of stories there. Certainly one of the biggest ones is moving the store. Campus Partners was essentially demolishing a number of Midwest universities, the communities around there. And campus really was changing a lot. Also, the format, the engagement of the customer was changing. They were moving even away from CDs at that point in time. So it made a lot of sense to start fresh. We had an opportunity to move still in the campus area, but just on the outer edge at Hudson and Summit. And the store used to be originally in what I call the basement. Mm-hmm. Then it went in the attic. And now, I don't know if the people on the radio can't see this, but I do a little fist pump. Now we're on the street. You know, the store is literally on the street. You can see it from the road.
Finally, you made it to street level.
Right. So I think that's kind of a funny take on it. But yeah, it was certainly the move was a big deal. Provided much more space. We did move the stage from the old store to the new store. A lot of the physical stuff we had, the counter was moved from the old store to the new store. So we definitely were focused on bringing the vibe that we had and really put it on steroids. That's how I look at it. By moving the store, having more exposure, bringing the old elements that kind of were the legacy of the store, but then elevating it a lot by what we did when we revamped the new space.
Would you say your business is more focused on new releases or the used part? How do you split it?
It's absolutely both.
Mm-hmm.
So originally, School Kids and Youse Kids, the reason Youse Kids is called Youse Kids, there was a store called School Kids. Kurt and a guy named Dan Dow kind of came together on having a used side of School Kids Records, thus the Used Kids Records name.
That I struggled to say.
Yes, I know.
I guess, just say it slow.
I know.
How, yeah.
But when School Kids Records went out of business, there were two separate businesses. When School Kids went out of business, essentially, Used Kids started carrying new stock. Not a lot, but once it still wasn't a lot when I bought the store in 2014. But we've definitely brought that more to a balance. It's roughly 50-50. We have a huge inventory of used records. Every day we're buying used records. Mm-hmm. So and obviously a lot of new stuff. So we honestly, it's like someone brings in their old, Rod Stewart record and wants to trade it in for a new Foo Fighters record or something. You know, it's not an even trade, but you know, they'll get some money off towards their next purchase. So it's a better energy.
2026 marks the store's 40th anniversary. That's a big deal. Are you doing anything to celebrate?
We're doing a lot of stuff. but definitely September of 2026 is going to be the pinnacle. Mm-hmm. We are very actively booking a series of shows celebrating Used Kids Records' 40th anniversary, it's the month of September, at a variety of clubs, Cafe Bourbon Street, Rumba, Ace of Cups, Space Bar, probably some other clubs mix in there. But we also will have some shows at the shop. But there will be vanity shows when I say that, because I personally love hard rock. And I'm trying really hard to get bands to come into the States.
What the owner wants, the owner wants.
Well, <Yeah. laughs> it'll be soul, it'll be jazz, it'll be hip hop, it'll be hard rock, it'll be punk, it'll be hardcore. Literally every night we'll have a different kind of theme. And we're not quite sure. It's a little early to throw anything out there, but we are in communication with a number of booking agents and bands to get them to come to Columbus and celebrate our 40th anniversary, as well as local bands.
Your website says that you are always buying used vinyl, CDs, and music memorabilia. So I was hoping you'd tell me something truly amazing someone has brought in and sold to you.
I'll just tell you what popped in my head.
Yeah.
So it wasn't brought in, but we do house calls also. So sometimes we have older folks or folks that are just have too much stuff and they prefer that we come to their homes. Well, there was a gentleman over in Clintonville that apparently was I don't want to quite say he was a roadie, but he would show up for every show for a band called Rosie. Rosie, a guy named Mark Chatfield, is the main guy through a couple bands I'll tell you about. But anyway, he had this kind of, the fellow that I was buying the stuff from had this relationship with the band where he would help them bring in their gear and all this kind of stuff. Well, he ended up getting the banner that hung behind the band. And it's a kind of a gold kind of fabric with the word Rosie on it. Mm. Well, Rosie was the precursor band to the Gods. So if you know the Gods here in town, famous guy named Eric Moore who led the band, Mark Chatfield was in the band. Mark went on to be a guitarist in Bob Seger's band. So a legendary guitarist, a legendary figure in the rock and roll scene here in Columbus. But it's just super cool to have that banner. Now, somewhat ironically, not long after I bought that thing, this young lady comes in the shop and I see her sign, her last name is Chatfield. I said, "Are you Mark Chatfield's daughter?" She said, "Yeah." So I ran upstairs and grabbed it and said, "You got to see this thing." And she said, "Oh my God." You know, she was really into it.
Do you still have it?
Or
you're not going to sell it?
Okay. Never, ever.
Never.
We do not sell the memorabilia.
I
do have one other cool story to tell you if I have a moment.
Yeah, you have. Okay. Go for it.
So there, I really kind of regret this club is gone. A club called Al Rosa Villa. It was up on Sinclair Avenue. A lot of great stuff happened there. There was one very tragic thing that happened there, but they had a ton of great rock and roll shows. Some punk stuff, but a lot of metal. It's primarily a metal bar. At any rate, when it went out of business, they had an auction, which I completely missed, which was a real bummer. But I did just kind of stumble in there and knock on the door, and there was the auctioneer cleaning up, and I bought some stuff out of the place. Well, years later, to put up in the store, by the way, that's why I buy that stuff.
Yeah.
So years later, there's an auction here in town, and that auction was roughly a year ago. I go to the auction, and the fellow that was having the auction had a lot of memorabilia from Al Rosa Villa, because he had a relationship with the bar. I'm not sure if he worked there or what the exact relationship was. But he actually had the sign from Al Rosa Villa that was on the street. And this thing is quite large, maybe 10, 12 feet long by about 4 feet high. The cool story about it, one, I bid like crazy, and I said, I'm not leaving this place. I said this to myself. I'm not leaving it until I own that thing.
Yeah.
So I bought the thing, and the cool thing was the story. So apparently, Eric Moore from the Gods was leaving the club one night angry, and the fellow that owned the bar, Rick, was apparently didn't pay him, or there was some disagreement about the money. Well, Eric Moore leaves the parking lot. Kids, I don't recommend you do this. He leaves the parking lot, pulls out a gun, shoots the Al Rosa sign several times,
and leaves.
Well, Rick later goes to Eric's house and pulls out a baseball bat and beats the crap out of Eric's car. At any rate, the sign literally has bullet holes in it. So eventually we'll be framing it, putting backlights on it, and putting it up in the shop.
So you can see the hole. Yeah, you got it.
Yeah.
All right.
And that's the thing about the stuff on our walls. Here's another great story. I've got a Cramps poster. I mean, there's a guy named Bruce Nutt who owned a club here in town called Crazy Mamas. Crazy Mamas in the late—I don't know when Bruce opened that thing. I'm going to say sometime in the 70s. But I went there a million times. There are great bands that played there. Gun Club, David Johansen, Sam and Dave, the Cramps. I mean, there's just a gazillion bands that he booked in that place. A ton of rockabilly bands. At any rate, where the heck was I going with that?
Something you're going to hang in the store.
Oh, so I've got this Cramps. Well, thank you. So many stories. I've got this Cramps poster in there. And just to illustrate why I don't sell this stuff, I have tons of customers that walk up. It's an original poster from the show with the original handwriting that says, you know, Crazy Mamas and all this kind of stuff. And the poster itself is beat to crap, okay? But it just was a poster that I can't tell you how many times people have said, hey, is this stuff for sale? No. It's for you to enjoy and just have, you know, some kind of discourse. Physical, right?
Yeah.
It's a physical thing. It's not AI.
You got to come in to see it.
You got to come in to see it. And I tell people all the time, take a picture of it.
Yeah.
Take a selfie with it, whatever.
Yeah.
But that I hate the idea of being a museum. My inventory is to be sold, the records, et cetera. But what's on the wall is to kind of embrace that legacy of Columbus's music scene and Central Ohio in general. So to me, that is critical.
We have been talking to Greg Hall, owner of Used Kids Records. And obviously, I could talk to you for a full hour about about music history. Well, that's a different show. But Greg, thank you so much for coming in today.
Amy, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Coming up, we're going to talk with a local artist who has traveled the world and now calls Columbus home. That's when Fascinating Ohio continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And this is Fascinating Ohio, a show that introduces you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. She was born in Taiwan, raised in Belize, and attended college in Canada. Now living in Columbus, this artist puts the rhythm of her worldly movement into her art. Yanni Sheng is an artist who works out of the High Road Gallery and Studios in Worthington, where she creates art and reflects on her experiences. Welcome to All Sides, Yanni.
Thank you so much for having me, Amy.
So you've lived many different places all around the world. What drew you to Columbus?
Oh, goodness. Initially, when I first moved here, because I fell in love with someone from Columbus.
So that person brought you here. But then what made you stay?
Oh, actually, when I stayed, it's because when I realized the rich history and the cultural, you know, aspect in Columbus, it's just fascinating. Hmm.
So how has moving and travel affected or inspired your artwork?
I think moving and travel really does help me and feel inspired. When you engage with different people around the world, you learn something. When you speak to them, just a little conversation, you walk away with a world of like experience almost, you know, because you're reading their facial expression, you're engaging what they want to talk about or how's your day. You initially get a good idea how the environment feels around different areas when you live in.
How many years have you been in Columbus?
Let's see, since 2016.
Okay.
Yeah.
So do you think Columbus is home forever, or are you going to travel?
Oh, forever. Absolutely. Yeah, okay. Yeah, forever. But definitely I would like to give myself opportunity to travel and visit different places in the United States. I mean, once again, I can't stress enough to a lot of people that the United States is huge. Mm. There's cultural all across, and you know, you got to learn about it. Even you're in the United States, when you go see different places, you take in what is available there and the culture, the building, the history, the people, all that.
Whenever I was doing some research about you, I learned some new word. Can you tell us what Natsuki is? Am I saying that right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Natsuke.
Yeah, okay. Natsuke. So I'm saying it wrong. I'm sorry.
Natsuke, too. It's good. Natsuke is actually a traditional small miniature sculpture. Mm. And it's carved back in Japan. What it does is when you use it, is that they carve this little about inch and a half or 1 inch miniature sculpture of different, could be mythical creatures, could be everyday life, like a broom or something like that. But it's so tiny that it's use it as a toggle. So you take it, you put it with the rope, you put it right between your belt. So obi is what they call it, the Japanese belt they use to keep the kimono together. Mm-hmm. So you can hold, the little sculpture actually helped to keep the little pouch attached with the rope. So you can have money, medicines, or smoking pouch.
So rather than just a boring bead,
you
carve it and make it interesting.
Yes.
Okay. And so you, that's a part of your work. You do those?
Yes, yeah. I do. Yeah. I did some research on that area and try to inspire myself and really dig into my Japanese background and be inspired and take it and represent it again.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we are talking with artist Yanni Sheng. So your art also has a flowing, sort of undulating look to it. I believe you even did a whole series entitled Flow. Can you tell me what inspired you with the flow? Yeah.
Wow. The flow is actually all, could be almost anything. Flow in and out could be used in languages, but when it comes to flow in art, especially my area of painting my work, is to think about the rhythm and the body itself that has energy, you know, and how do we move into position, like everyday walking. But I practice yoga, so I think of myself like when I move and flow into a different pose, yoga pose, how do I do that? And how do my muscle reacts and it works and how the energy works? So I like to depict them in colors and emerging them very fluidly and organically.
And another type of work you do is carving into linoleum. And
yes,
they look beautiful, but also very intricate. Can you talk to me about that process?
Okay. Yeah. Carving linoleum, any type of carving, is so different from painting, because when you paint, if you make a mistake, you can layer it over, you know, cover it up. But when you do carving, because you're using chisels and gougers, you're unable to do that. So what you do, when you make a cut, you want to be as precise as possible. And if you make a mistake, it's hard to glue it back. So
So you have to start over if you make a mistake.
Yeah, or try to fix it. You know, there's little tricks for fixing it, but it's not the same.
So you've mentioned carving little animals. You mentioned carving linoleum, and you mentioned painting. What kind of artist are you? Are you a painter? Or are you a carver?
I don't know. I just enjoy to be inspired by things that are around me and people, you know, and like you having a chat with you, I'm so inspired being in this studio right now and looking at everything is just so fascinating in my perspective.
Is my radio studio going to turn into artwork?
Oh, I think so. I just feel like this building and then it's just like for the work I'm doing now is kind of like that, like places that imbue histories and imbue stories and is interactive with the human every day.
What artwork are you making now?
Right now is the carving, especially. Mm. It's all about the Ohio architecture. Mm. Spaces that tell story and captures history. And one of them I have done just recently is Ohio Theater. Carving the outside of Ohio Theater, even with the few buildings that are attached to it. Mm. And people are walking and just presenting a different perspective how art can be looked at.
Carving into linoleum?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
And how big are we talking?
I think the one I have is 28 by 19.
Okay. 28 inches?
28 inches by 19. Or
I was like 28
by...
feet?
Oh, no. Well, that would be great.
That would be a lot.
Bring
yeah.
out the roller.
Well, you also, I found from another story about you, you have tattoos on both your arms.
Yes, I do.
And is one side Japanese and one side Chinese?
Yes, it does. So, wait.
That's how you can, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So on my left side of arm is actually a Japanese koi. Mm. And it's designed by Jamer Lindsay back when I was living in Vancouver Island. So what I love about it is that it tells a story and I'm able to capture my backgrounds. So it reminds me every time when I look at it, I say, look at this cute koi. I love koi. But I'm like, it's Japanese koi. Mm-hmm. There's history behind it. Kois eat lots of bugs when they're in the flooded rice paddy field. So that's what they use them for. Instead of crayfish, you have koi that goes around, eat the bugs and get rid of the pests around, kind of pest control around the rice field.
Mm, yeah. Okay. And then that's one side. And then the other side is it Chinese?
Yes, it is Chinese. And this one is a food dog. So it's a protective concept. It's an animal that you often seen when you're by the temple, Asian temples, Chinese temples. Or Japanese temple. There's always two lions on one on each side. Mm. And what it does is that it reminds me the fact that I'm a very protective person. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the images is all about guarding. Mm. And the spirituality in the aspect of this kind of brings me a sense of joy. That, you know, I believe I am a very protective person, I think, and it kind of reflects really well for me and also culturally my background, Chinese background from my grandfather's side.
If our listeners Google you, you can find the article that I'm talking about where you talked about the tattoos.
Yes.
You can see them since we're on the radio. But yes, but but did you design them yourself?
No, I didn't. Okay. Actually, the artist I work with, James, he passed away back in 2011. Very unfortunate. I was the last person that he tattooed. For tattooing, especially when you get a full arm, it takes a while to get them done. But when you're visiting your artist pretty much once every 2 weeks, you get to know them. You get to talk about stories and his histories and how he become what he does and music that he likes. You know, you kind of it feels really a form of artwork on your body, but you're getting so much out of it when you walk away.
And you mentioned the koi that you have on your one arm, and you've incorporated koi like that one in your other art too. You've said that koi saved you.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Well, when I was little, I think I was about six and a half. Me and my friends were playing around. My family went to visit a good friend, our family friends, that owns like a koi factory. Well, not factory. I would say like a farm. A koi farm. And what they do is like you have a lot of big pools, like square pools with full of kois. And I remember running around in the boardwalk, just hanging out, just chasing someone else, but there was a wet puddle on the floor. So all of a sudden, I just slipped. I fell in the water, and I didn't even know the koi pond. I did not know how to swim. So falling into the koi pond was a bit of a shock for me. I couldn't swim. I tried to hold on, and I grabbed a piece of board or somewhere that I was held onto a wood. And then all of a sudden, I felt the koi just swarm all around me. It's an incredible experience, and they're slippery, but they're pushing. They're literally, I don't know if they're trying to eat me, but at the time as a kid, I was like, oh my goodness, I get to step on you. That's how I feel a bit, like, you know, being saved by koi. Because
they pushed you up out of the water?
They pushed me off the water. Like, wow. Yeah, so it was kind of like, oh my goodness.
That's a great story.
I was much lighter then. I'm sure now it's not
the koi wouldn't
the
save
same.
You now.
Yeah.
I also read that you are an instructor at the McConnell Arts Center and also the Mansfield Arts Center. Talk to me about teaching art to others. How is that for you?
Well, I think it's very rewarding. That's the first thing I gotta say. Teaching has always been something that always in the back of my mind, but I was born with a learning disability, and I also have a few anxiety background due to childhood trauma when it comes to education, and that is very close to my heart. Once again, like, as a kid, I was not very, I did not succeed in my curriculum careers, you know, and a lot of stuff. I was judged and discriminated for having low marks. And the way I was taught in Asia was very different back in the 80s. So it was a lot scarier compared to now. And I think that gives me a whole new sense of how I can contribute in teaching to help kids grow and find art to be fascinating and something that it's accessible for them and help them to express their feeling as well, or just enjoy of creating.
Do you teach young kids, or are we talking older kids? Like, what? And are you teaching them painting? Like, what or are we carving linoleum with 6-year-olds?
Oh, you'll be surprised. Yeah. If you're 3, I could get it. I mean, after I saw a video back in a long time ago, I saw an Amazon child is able to use a machete, and he's only 3 years old, chopping wood. That threw me off. I mean, that imagery-wise is so intimidating to me. I could never imagine our North American kids holding a machete and try to cut wood, you know. That's kind of scary for me. But then it almost gave me a sense like, wow, they're capable. We're born with the ability of learning, and we're able to, you know, copy and reinterpret it the way how it works for us. So when it comes to art in general, when I teach kids, it's all range. If you're willing to learn, I'm here for you. That's all it is. Yeah, I teach adults too, but with kids, it's really close to my heart. So I teach oil painting for children. They could start when they're like 7 years old usually, or first or second grades. My background of education is secondary education. So I teach a little bit older kids. I enjoy the secondary education kids because they have full of emotion, full of ideas, full of energy. They haven't lost that yet. By the time you hit in high school, you kind of started to chill out a little bit more, you know? Yeah.
Did you ever think, you know, when you were a kid struggling in school, did you think that you would have a life as an artist?
No, I did not, actually. I knew I always love art. I always love drawings and creating and making stuff. I never thought I would have it as a career. I thought about, hey, maybe it'll be great one day, but I never really think that will be the case for me. For an Asian girl, you know, a lot of time you have a family, maybe it is traditional, they want you to nurse, doctor, typical. Lawyer, maybe. Yeah. Businessman is more common.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you found your niche as an artist, right?
I do. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. So the architecture series you're doing about the history of Columbus, is that something you're still working on? Is that going to be
Is
it going to be a show somewhere?
Yes. I'm aiming for 2028. And once again, my studio is over at Hyrule Gallery, and it's right in Worthington. I work with 12 different artists in the same gallery, and we all have our studio room. And I'm very fortunate because when I get bored, I get to talk to them and then get ideas and then, you know, just engaging with like-minded people that helps to facilitate my growth. And especially with carving, it's a lot of time just in your own head. So it's nice to work with, you know, having a studio mate with you, would chat with you. And it could be about anything, you know, like that. For carving, I have to say that I have carved since I was little, and I love different type of artwork, and I don't believe I should limit myself to just one, like one type of art that I will only pursue. I believe as a creative person, perhaps we could grab things that inspire us and then create art from it, you know? I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I was just going to say, we've been talking with artist Yanni Sheng, and I want to thank you so much for your time today. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And this is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. One entrepreneur has single-handedly brought the taste of the Middle East to the Midwest, and it's all food. He's a franchise owner of multiple restaurants and cafes and brings different Middle Eastern-inspired menus, from Palestinian breads, Yemeni coffee, to shawarma and desserts. Owner Ibrahim Almahira joins us today. Welcome to All Sides.
Hey, Amy. Thank you so much.
So I couldn't keep track of all of the names of your different restaurants and menu offerings, so I'm going to need you to help me out. Name all of your restaurants for us.
Yeah, of course. First of all, I would like to thank you all, Izza and you, for having me here.
Yeah.
I will, you know, list them as we started, like how we started now. We started with Qumriya Yemeni Coffee. It's a specialty coffee shop. Now we have two branches, the third coming soon. And the second one was like Berline, the same time, Juice Time and Almanakish. Juice Time is smoothies, ice creams, all fresh products. And Almanakish, it's Mediterranean pizza style, I would call it. And then we did Farouj Abu Abed. This is 100% on charcoal barbecue, Lebanese grill. And we did Baba Knafe and the second branch of Juice Time.
Is that it? Oh, my goodness. So what you just listed there, that's six different places?
So we have seven places as physical stores, you know, and we have around four brands. And there's more coming.
Wow. Okay. So that's a lot of businesses. Let's back up here. So what made you decide to start and open a business? You know, running a small business, especially in the food industry, is hard. And now you have seven and more to come. Like, what made you decide this is what I want to do?
I would say it was not a me plan. It was God plan. I'm you know, as you may know, I'm a student. So I was just working as a middle high school teacher. And then I love going to the coffee shop to study, right? And there's no like late night coffee shops. The only one was, it's the Qumriya, but it's not owned by me. It's the other franchisee. So I didn't like they close, you know, 12. I want something more. And I'm a student. I go there. I did my, you know, homework, study there. I love the environment, specialty coffee, you know, the vibe for the students to be there. So that's why I opened the first one, the Lewis Center. And
so you decided that it was something that you particularly needed, but you decided that other people would want this.
Oh,
too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I felt like the Buckeye community, those people around me, if I'm needed of it, and I'm one of the communities like they need it too. And the other thing is I wanted, you know, like the cushion seatings that you always find in the coffee shop sometimes, specialty. I wanted to have it bigger. That's why I did it 85 feet of seatings. So I want people to come in and to not fight on one bench. I want them to all have it, you know, there. So I have a structure mind in my set, my mind, and I'm involved in the community. You know, I found the Jordanian Student Organization at the Ohio State University, was the founder president. I'm still involved in it as a, you know, co-advisor, but that what got you involved in the community, knowing the people and started that.
So you just mentioned you're originally from Jordan.
That's correct.
So how did that influence any of these restaurants? Because I mentioned that they all have a Middle Eastern flair, but we're talking, you mentioned a bunch of different cuisines. So how does your being from Jordan influence this?
So I was born and raised in Jordan, mm-hmm. right? And I mentioned to you a little bit before we got into air that, you know, I did my master's in the UK, did the high diploma in Europe. So I traveled around the world a little bit. Mm-hmm. I got the taste of, you know, multiple country cultures. I think it influenced me 100% because most of those brands, they already established in Jordan. So it doesn't mean they started in Jordan. They may be like in Kuwait, most of that brands started like the headquarters, but they have their first branches opens right away in Jordan. Jordan is like a place where they open like a lot of food places. So I tasted them before. I liked them. It's like, you know, why not bring them here? That, you know, bring authentic places, have people here had the chance to try it without going to Jordan or going to the Middle East to try something out.
So I'm guessing that these were first of its kind for Central Ohio, at least. But are they first of the kind for Ohio or
yeah,
and beyond?
Yeah, some of them first in the States, like mm-hmm. Farooj Abdulabad. Mm-hmm. We, the one, there's 20 or 30 more coming, but we were the first in the States.
Oh, okay. Wow. Okay. Yeah. So that one that you just mentioned, I saw a video of it opening earlier in the summer. There was like a really long line, right?
Yes.
Tell me about the community response.
Oh my God. We love the community, mm-hmm. like all type of communities. So always, you know, we love them. We try to pay back what we owe them, the community with their support. We try our best in the social media to be out there to let people know, you know, we're coming, be ready, you know, to spread the word. But the community were supportive for us from day one, all other type mm-hmm. of communities, not like the Mediterranean only. No, like everyone, if you go to our lines, you will see like all different type of communities there, which is we love, you know, this place for everyone.
And the am I saying it right? It's Farooj?
Farooj. Farooj means chicken, like
okay.
the chicken when it's like a whole chicken.
Yeah.
That's what means in Arabic.
Yeah. So where is that located?
So located in 7721 Summer Road, mm-hmm. Dublin. And the juice time is literally next door, 7717 Summer Road, Dublin. This is like, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I noticed that a lot of your places are side by side. Did you do that on purpose? Or?
Not really. None of them were planned. So I would have to thank, you know, my agent. He's like the person behind the scenes that he gets me to the places I wanted to be in. Mm-hmm. Like very high traffic where the big brands wanted to be. His name is Austin from Passive Group. So he always hunts for places for me. Mm-hmm. And we usually, I told you, it's a good plan. We get like Camarillo, we got the place in front of Meyer. Mm-hmm. And while we're doing the construction, the next door, we realize they're leaving. But the network, the relationship with the landlord, with the tenants, with neighbors, got me to the point they will give it to me right away because they know who am I, like as a person. Because mm-hmm. when they knew me, there was like no, okay, I don't want it to that place, right? I'm just dealing with you as a person. And yeah, they liked me. They was like, you know what, we're not going to post in the market. The same thing happened with the next door, the Farooj and Juice Time.
Mm-hmm.
The landlords wanted to give me both places.
They're like, you're a good tenant. Let's keep you here.
Yeah, and they're cousin businesses. You know, yeah. They help each other. They help the shopping center. Mm-hmm. They help everyone. And even when people want to go out, instead of going to multiple places far away from each other, it's like, you know what, we'll go. It's all in one, you know, go have lunch, have dessert. You know,
One-stop shop,
yeah.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And we're talking about how Ibrahim Al-Mahira has brought a taste of the Middle East to Columbus in the form of a lot of different restaurants. I wanted to talk a little bit more about you, because besides all of these businesses, I mean, are these all just side hustles to what you're actually doing, right? Because you have a whole other career. You are currently at Ohio State. You're a PhD student in kinesiology. Tell me about that.
Of course. This is something I'm passionate about, right? Mm-hmm. So I found myself in the business. You know, I tried to, I was like, I'm good in this. I have the skills. I use the research skills in the business, finding, you know, good equipments and all that. And at the same time, this is what originally I've been doing. Master's, PhD, and now I'm doing my PhD, kinesiology. I loved it. I'm a good researcher. And, you know, I'm that type of person. If I'm free, I'm bored, I'm not productive.
You'd like to be busy.
Like really busy. Like if I'm not busy, I think my productivity level will go down a little bit or something. So I discovered that by myself, but it's a lot. Sometimes I have like 3-4 hours of sleeping, sometimes more. But, you know, I kind of like that as of now. I tell people maybe 5-10 years from now, I'll be like tired. Mm-hmm. But so far I loved it, especially when you open a store, accomplish something, see people on lines, you forget all that, you know, late night of working.
So you are more, you're a franchise owner, but would you call yourself at all like a chef or like a food, you make any of the food in any of the places?
No, I'm a good barista. I'm an excellent barista, I would say. But no, I'm not a chef. That's why I go and get a franchise, because mm-hmm. I'm a business owner. I discover I know how to open business, operate it. You know, I learn from everyone, from other brands. But the thing is, the reason people come to me is like, hey, you're smart, you're so on, so why don't you open your own thing? I tell them, I expand more by getting franchises. We're very well established. They taste excellent. They have the packaging and all that, you know, standard stuff. So why not have people win-win? You know, mm-hmm. the franchise owner, they worked hard. They win, they get their royalties or whatever the deal is. And me, I will be able to expand more, right? Mm-hmm. And make sure, what I have is a specific recipe. If I get anyone to do it worker-wise, they will have to follow the recipe and do it. We will not have a different taste. We will not have a different daily problems because I don't have the chef experience, right? So that's why I go toward more of, you know, franchising. And it's a good thing so far.
So how are you balancing both careers, that being a PhD student and being an owner of all these franchises with more to come? Which one is your 10-year plan?
Oh, of course, my study. You know, my you know, me being a PhD student took me long time, efforts, money, and everything you could call it. And I loved it. It's something I loved. I want to work in it one day. But the business is something, I'm passionate about it too. I love solving problems. I love the community. So just back to the question, the balance is more of I created the right team, the trust, you know, and the community support, all is the system, right? So I try to have put a lot of time on creating a system like pilot, like, you know, this store is coming. There is a structure. I would not say I will follow like the traditional structure of other restaurants, like whatever it is as of like a management structure. No, I follow the most effective structure. Like, hey, what's the best way for us to not waste time? I almost have zero meetings. Because if we can solve it over a text, let's solve it over a text. You know, if the meeting is something like, maybe sometimes we have to do a meeting. I'm not saying I'm not with the meetings things.
Yeah.
But I would say creating the right system that works the best for you at this level. Maybe tomorrow will be bigger stores. We have to have like that traditional structure of having meetings, set up meetings and all that.
You have a strong social media presence as well. There's a lot of, you try to make some funny content on there. How has that helped your businesses grow? Do you find that's a good way to communicate with people?
This is the best way so far. So we're one of maybe the best social media accounts business-wise in Ohio, and we love that. And we hope that other businesses, you know, will be positively impacted by us, so we will have other competitors to compete with, like, in the same effect. That's why where the whole world is going to right now. So we're trying to follow the trends in the right way. And, social media supported us to spread the word, letting people know we are here. But the main supporter is the community. You know, the Buckeye community, the Mediterranean, Asian, Black, white, all the other communities, they've been there for us. And, even if we have a strong social media and if we don't have community support, it's nothing, right? So I think the social media is the tool we use to get to the people. And so far, it's, you know, it's the best tool we have used.
And some of these franchises that you have, are they one of the first here in the United States?
Yes.
So you started this, but you said that there's more coming. Did you lead them to this idea? Basically, you were like, you proved that it can work.
I agree. This is one of the things we approved, especially, you know, with our like an internal community, right? Mm-hmm. The other people's like, okay, you know, it's working. There's lines, there's people, there's a high demand. Let's do something similar. I love that. Some people call me, ask me, hey, how to do this, this and that. You know, guide us. I love that because that's a good influence on the other people. The other thing is this is an exclusive here for you guys. We have a Sharoma place coming next to the Camarilla at the 6181 Summer Road. We just took over the space and it will be the third space in the Shopping Center out of four spaces.
Oh, wow.
The five,
okay.
You know, where's the Five Guys?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
we have Almanakish Camarilla. There is like store we took over just 2 days ago. This is like exclusive. And we're doing a shawarma. We call it like Beirut street food.
Okay.
We will sell shawarma, like very authentic, good shawarma. And, you know, it will be different from any other shawarma you have tasted. It will be like the original one.
Wow. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
That sounds great. And unfortunately, we are out of time. But I want to thank you for telling me about your busy life and
so
all
much.
Of your restaurants, which was that going to be number eight then when that would have...
as a store-wise, yeah.
Yeah. All right. We have been talking with restaurant owner, entrepreneur, Ibrahim Almahara, who has brought a unique taste to Columbus in the form of many restaurants. Thank you so much for your time
thank
today.
Thank you, Ami. Thank you, Iza. Thank you for the whole production team. And yeah. Thank you all.
Yes, and this has been Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you for joining us. I'm Amy Jarovich.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.